Well, hello, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England. This is Leonard Maltin, and the person chuckling because he didn't know I was going to say that is Baron Vaughn.
He means princes and kings in a gender-neutral sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn, so you've now met the entire cast of characters.
That's right. He's the king, I'm the prince, so don't mean to usurp you. But here we go.
Watch that usurpment.
That's true.
Just careful with that.
Usurp, I serp, he serps. Yes. All right, serps up.
No need to conjugate any further.
Okay. Perfect.
Yeah. Hi, folks. We're just in a silly mood right now.
We are.
We're also in a good mood because we've seen a couple of
great movies.
Yeah, yes. Great is the word. We have two movies today that are genuinely great and one that is just grating.
How long have you been waiting to use that one?
I did not plan that.
That came out of
it's
you.
It's just an accurate comment.
It's a visceral reaction to
it's not wrong, is it?
Our second movie.
It's not incorrect.
No, it's not.
No.
And a lot of people I love are in it, but we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. We're talking about not just novels, but books. Books adapted as movies.
Right.
And, of course, that covers hundreds, if not thousands, of possibilities, of which we chose three. And why don't we get right into it? The first one we chose is one of the very best. One of the best of all time, I would say.
Oh, okay.
I think so.
It's a damn good movie.
You know, when I was a kid, I'll talk a little about this later on, but when I was a kid and got really movie crazy, movie struck, if I saw a film that really engaged me and involved me in a way, I would then read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I started reading Charles Dickens, truly, as a teenager because I so fell in love with David Lean's film A Great Expectations.
Okay.
The MGM version of David Copperfield with Freddie Bartholomew and W.C. Fields.
Those are very ambitious adaptations.
Yes, they are. And those are great adaptations.
Yeah.
Because in both, you know, Dickens wrote, you know, huge, huge books.
Gigantic masterpieces.
Yes.
Essentially the greatest, some people say the greatest author in the English language besides Shakespeare.
Such a great storyteller and such wonderfully colorful characters. So I became a Dickens fan because of the movies, and then that led me to the books. And that's not a bad way to go, I really think, because they're different.
Very.
They're never the same. And when you're talking about books as weighty as those, just in terms of sheer volume, the volume of the volumes, you're never going to get everything in the movie anyhow.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people always have that argument that, oh, the book was better, but the book was a book. And you used your imagination whilst reading that book. And, of course, a movie is never going to be as good as your imagination.
No.
But some movies can capture things in a way that you were not expecting, that are surprising, that are new and very different than reading a novel.
Reading a novel is such a personal experience.
Very.
And it's an interior experience, of course. It's all in your mind. It's something personal, a connection that the author makes with you. And
a good author, at least.
A good author, exactly. Because it triggers everything that your imagination could possibly conjure up. The author can get inside many people's heads, can tell it from many characters' points of view, can be omniscient.
Can flip perspectives.
All of those things that movies mostly can't do or movies don't easily manage to do. And that's one of the first big differences is just that. That authorial point of view or that authorial opportunity to take on different guises and different narrators.
There's a great book called Written on the Body by Jeanette Winterson that is told in first person, and you never know the gender of the person telling the story.
How interesting.
And they've been wanting to turn this into a movie, but picking if it's a man or a woman would ruin everything.
Wow.
That's an example.
So what are we saying is one of the best ever? We're saying The Cider House Rules.
You're saying that, but I do like it a lot.
Oh, you're not as enthusiastic as I.
No. I mean, you know, I need to, I don't want to denigrate it, but it's a brilliant film.
I love it.
Yeah.
I just love it. I loved it when I saw it in 1999.
And you loved it again.
I loved it again.
And I loved it too. And I love it.
It's just for pedigree, it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Score, Best Editing, Best Art Direction. That score by Rachel Portman is not only beautiful, but it's used all the time. It's licensed for commercials. There's one playing on TV right now that uses that theme.
You need that dramatic music.
Yeah. But it did win, too. It won Best Supporting Actor for Michael Caine, who is great, even though his accent is a little wonky.
Michael Caine is so good that I always forgive his accent.
Exactly so. And for John Irving, the great American novelist who chose to adapt his own book for the first time.
Which is rare.
It's very rare, and he had never tried it before. And it was such an interesting experience for him that he wrote a book about that. called My Movie Business, which is a good read. It's a slender book, but an interesting one. Because Irving, he's had a better batting average than almost any living author I can think of, starting with The World According to Garp, a great film from 1982, then The Hotel New Hampshire, which was directed by Tony Richardson in 1984, then Simon Birch. Not everybody loves that film, but it's a real tearjerker that I'm fond of from 1998, which is based on A Prayer for Owen Meany. And then a film that almost nobody saw that I hope we can tackle one day here on our podcast called The Door in the Floor.
Yeah, I didn't see it. 2004.
Great performance by Jeff Bridges. It's based on a very small section of his novel, A Widow for 1 Year.
Okay.
So again, I would say John Irving has fared much better than most authors in the screen treatments of his work. But The Cider House Rules is probably at the top of that heap, of that very small heap.
I believe so. I mean, it's a movie that a lot of people know. Besides Garp, it's a movie that a lot of people know.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't, we invite you to see it because it's a film that and again, revisiting it, I found myself getting absorbed in it all over again. It creates a mood and an atmosphere like you want to be in this movie. You want to be there. You want to be right there sharing these experiences. And you are sharing these experiences. It takes place, I don't know how they did the location scouting for this film, but it's so perfect. It takes place in Maine at an old sort of, I guess a mansion is what you'd call it. It's an old mansion.
An estate.
It's perched high on a hill above the railroad station in a remote town in Maine. And it's cut off from the world, which is appropriate for the story because they are cut off from everything there. And it's now an orphanage presided over by Michael Caine's character, Dr. Larch, Dr. Wilbur Larch, who is an unconventional fellow. He is goodness personified, but he runs it his own way. He's an eccentric.
Yeah, and we get a sense in the film that he is he's been burned by the world at large, and so is trying to create a place where people feel cared for and loved, and happens to be a home for orphans.
Right, and he's at a hospital.
And a hospital, of which he is a doctor, and a very good one.
Yes, he is. And he does something that very few people do at that time. And this is in the late 30s, early 40s that this story unfolds. He performs abortions because, again, he loves life. He loves children. He doesn't want to see young women suffer. And so this is a choice he's made, that he will do that. He will help them. And also he sees the results of botched abortions, and he sees the anguish of these young women who come to him, and he wants to comfort them.
And it's a bit of a dilemma that gets examined in the story, especially once we meet his ward, I guess you could say, his young protege, played by Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, one of his best roles, one of his best performances.
Absolutely agree.
Tobey Maguire plays a character called Homer, who is Dr. Larch's protege in more ways than one. He's not just an orphan who never got adopted and left behind, but he's kind of the house favorite. And in his young life, Dr. Larch has taken him under his wing and essentially given him everything he needs to know about being a doctor. He has everything but a degree.
Yes.
He's learned well. He's learned from a very skilled surgeon.
Apprenticeship.
And but he lacks a degree. He has skill. He has knowledge. He has empathy. He has everything you'd want in a doctor. He just doesn't have that piece of paper. And that becomes an issue, of course, on more than one juncture in the story. And the nurses, the devoted nurses, are played by the wonderful Kathy Baker and the equally wonderful Jane Alexander. an example of the perfect casting in this film. Every role is so well filled. And what happens is that Homer starts getting some outsiders show up, a young couple who are in need of Dr. Larch's help.
Played by Charlize Theron and Paul Rudd.
And he's a soldier temporarily home from World War II and who has had this incident, doesn't want his family to know. And they want to try to hide the pregnancy, which is a very early pregnancy so far. So they take care of it, as they said in those days. It's taken care of. But their presence, their vitality as young adults sort of sparks in Homer the feeling that maybe he's been living this cloistered existence too long. Maybe he really does need to see the outside world. He's never been to the outside world.
It's time for him to find a family, whatever that means.
He's lived in this isolated environment, a very well self-contained environment.
And a loving one at that.
And a loving one indeed.
But there's a whole world out there.
Yeah.
And he's not seen any of it.
They show movies at night, except they have exactly one movie.
That always gets cut in the same place.
Yes. It's a 16-millimeter print of King Kong that they watch over and over and over and over. There are so many wonderful little quirks and little side grace notes, I guess you'd say, to this story. So Homer goes off with the young couple, and Dr. Larch is devastated by his departure. He can't believe that Homer's really going.
Essentially,
away.
He's lost his son.
Yes.
He talks about him as such and even admits to himself and to us as he narrates the beginning of the film that he feels like he's a father to this one particular boy, Homer, who now has to go.
The one thing that he does impress upon Homer is that anyone in any life has to be of use. That's it. That's the mantra. You have to be of use. So Homer sets out on his first journey to the outside world, and it turns out that Paul Rudd's family runs an apple farm. And he says, "I'll pick apples." He's not a snob.
Whatever you need him to do, he will do it.
So
he just wants to be of use.
He wants to be of use. So he sets up and he moves into the bunkhouse run by Delroy Lindo, who is sort of the overseer of the apple pickers.
Yeah, they have. I guess they're migrant workers, and they're here for the season, and this is what they do. And he takes him under. Delroy Lindo's character takes Tobey Maguire's character under his wing and teaches him the apple picking business.
Mm-hmm.
Get up in the tree, twist the apples. He notices the care in his hands, stuff like that. It's good stuff. And yeah. Erykah Badu is there as well.
As his daughter.
A fantastic singer-songwriter who does a hell of a job in this movie. There's a couple different characters in the Cider House is where they're all staying.
Yeah. We won't say more than that because we've just given you sort of the bare bones, the outline of what the film's about. But it does create the most vivid environment.
Yeah, to say the least,
Which is a credit both to John Irving and to the director, Lasse Hallström.
Lasse Hallström.
Who has done a lot of good movies over the years and who is known for films that – That really bring out, how do I put it?
Yeah, how do you put it?
That empathize with their characters, give you a strong sense of identification with the characters. Like What's Eating Gilbert Grape, that's one. My Life as a Dog is the film, the Scandinavian film that first brought him
Wait,
to the
Grape
world
or Garp?
Scene. Pardon me?
Grape or Garp?
What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Why am I cannot confuse. I mentioned Garp before.
No, Garp was directed by George Roy Hill.
Yes, and I mean Grape. That's what I mean.
What's Eating Gilbert?
I said Garp before. I meant Grape.
That's okay.
It's the world okay. According to, or is it Eating Gilbert? Who?
What's Eating Gilbert Grape? Clear your mind.
Okay.
All will be revealed. It's fine.
My mind's being eaten by Garp. By Garp.
Lasse Hallström has not had a perfect track record. He's had some films that have not turned out so well. He's had some flops.
He's batting like 45.
But he's had some wonderful films too. One of his films that I absolutely love that I couldn't pay people to go to see because it came out at the end of a calendar year and just got ignored.
Buried.
Was Casanova. Mm. A wonderfully rich, witty, funny film with Heath Ledger and Sienna Miller, and a great, great cast, and a wonderful script, and a great role for both the man and woman, leading man and leading woman. It's a very feminist film, actually, which is surprising given that the subject is Casanova.
Right.
Awfully good. And another film of his that got buried was called An Unfinished Life, with Robert Redford, Jennifer Lopez, and Morgan Freeman.
Good old Morgie Free.
And wonderful film. Of course, more popular would be Chocolat, which is not a film I'm crazy about, but many people did like that.
Especially if you like chocolate, set in a French way.
Yes. Hachi, A Dog's Tale, kind of got lost, but that's a very sweet and tearful movie as well. He's a good filmmaker. He's a really good filmmaker, and he had a great team with him. The production design by David Kropman in this film is pretty extraordinary. I mean, you just think like – you feel you're there.
Yeah, and it's one of those movies, and we kind of said that when we talked about Richard Linklater's Me and Orson Welles, that it doesn't hit you over the head with the time period.
No.
It's a suggestion that you get that never is it's never false. You're there with these people at this time. It's cold, cold Maine.
Yeah. And kudos to him. He has since done a little film called Life of Pi.
Heard of it.
Yeah. A very talented man. He did Hairspray. He did another old favorite of ours, Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Oh, yeah.
And he's worked with Lasse Hallström a number of times. And the photography by Oliver Stapleton, another really talented fellow who's worked with Hallström on many of his films, as well as The Grifters, Absolute Beginners. He's got a long, long list of credits, too. So this is all A-list people. This is a collaboration of
pedigree.
Very highly skilled, very, very talented people, including that wonderful cast. And as I say, if you're a John Irving fan, you certainly want to see it. And you might want to pick up that book, My Movie Business, which I found very, very interesting. I was lucky enough to interview him at the time the film came out.
Oh, nice.
Had a wonderful conversation with him. That was really fun. And, you know, there was also a play, which I didn't get to see.
Yeah, you were talking about it before.
It was a six-hour play.
If you want your plays to feel like a novel,
yep.
Make them 6 hours long.
Because it's a 640-page book.
Yeah.
And so it was a two-part play, which you could either see matinee and evening or two successive evenings. And it did play here in L.A., but I didn't get to see it. I'm sorry now that I didn't.
But it was very well reviewed.
Yes, yes. Very, very well reviewed. Very well thought of.
Well, you don't have to see that play while you have this film.
And of course, Irving said that one of the things about adapting his own work is that he could be ruthless. Mm. He could eliminate characters. He could eliminate subplots. And there was nobody to argue with him. There was nobody to say, no, you can't lose that. Oh, but that's no good. He really thought about it as a blank canvas and a whole new project, an endeavor based on his book. But he didn't have to be slavish to his own book. And
produced a great script,
right? Which I think is true also of the Harry Potter adaptations.
Yeah, with Steve Kloves.
Yeah, who did almost all of them. Those books also are very, very thick. There's a lot of incident in each one of those novels, and you couldn't put it all on screen. I think in some cases they put too much.
Mm-hmm.
That they should have pruned them even more. And of course, a lot of the Potter fanatics were upset that they cut as much as they did.
Yeah, but you can't do everything.
No.
You have to keep a certain through line to get through all, eight movies.
Right. I mean, the idea is to give the flavor of the book, the impression of the book, the overall, not just the tone, but the gist. It's a simple word, but I think that's what it is, the gist of the book. What is the book about? What is the book trying to convey? If you can do that in the movie, then you've done your job.
You have to fit it into a film form, you know, in which we're not going to have every single thought of every single character explained to us in beautiful prose. But with Cider House Rules, you know, it's, what is it, 2 hours long?
Just about 2 hours,
It doesn't feel like it.
No.
There's it's just over. I'm like, oh, I was watching that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's I did say this about Me and Orson Welles, in fact. I didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be over. It's the kind of film where you're so captivated. I was so captivated by the ambiance, by the characters, by the world that it created. I didn't want to leave. I would love to have just stayed there, lived there for a while.
Mm.
Which is why I don't think I would have minded that 6-hour play.
If it's as good as the film.
Yes. If it is as good as that. Well, not every adaptation scores a bullseye, as this one did.
Even the movie adaptation. although I do like that movie.
Oh, I like that movie too. Well, we've got a doozy coming up next. So this is a big, big movie.
Change that Z to a D, though. And that's a better description for this film.
Yes, this is a turkey that gobbles like nobody's business. And we'll reveal its name to you in just a moment.
Hey, everybody. This is Baron Vaughn from Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. Some of you might know that in addition to being a huge fan of movies, I sometimes show up in them, for I am an actor. And currently, right now, I'm on a Netflix, that's how you spell it, N-E-N-E-T-flix, no, just Netflix, a Netflix original series called Grace and Frankie. Grace is played by Jane Fonda. Frankie is played by Lily Tomlin. I play the adopted son of Lily Tomlin and Sam Waterston, and Jane Fonda's husband is played by Martin Sheen. But are they the husbands of their wives? That's sort of the conceit of the show. Check it out. It's streaming on Netflix right now, Grace and Frankie. Welcome back to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. I'm Baron Vaughn. Across from me is a man, Leonard Maltin. I didn't know if you were going to say it yourself.
What an introduction.
Yeah. Across from me is a man.
Boy.
Leonard Maltin.
Wow. Golly.
But
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Okay, good.
Actually, and I'm not going to.
But what are a couple of emotions that can be described with the color green? There's envy.
Yes.
Right. Green with envy. I think that's all. Green with rage. That's not a real thing.
No, I don't think so. We know it isn't easy being green.
It isn't. That's true. It's true. It's not easy being
what,
green.
What causes you to bring up that color, sir?
Oh, just because there's a character in this next movie to talk about.
Right. That's here's my problem.
Okay.
May I tell you my problem?
What's your problem?
Let me share with you my problem. I grew up on Dr. Seuss.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was growing up, he was still creating some of his now classic books. Because I was growing up in the 50s and into the early 60s.
So he hadn't even written Daisy Head Maisie yet.
That's right. He had already done three or four of his classics.
Mm.
And I fell in love with them, as did millions of other children and parents. And then I had the thrill of becoming a father myself and getting to reacquaint myself with them by reading them to my daughter, who, of course, fell in love with them too. Dr. Seuss is a magical name in my consciousness. He matters. He matters a lot. And he kept a very tight rein on his books and on his properties during his lifetime. And when he passed away, this is not unique. This has happened to other authors too. When he passed away, his widow, who was a devoted wife, I guess got talked into allowing some big shot Hollywood producers to come along and make feature films based on his books. Now, there's a fundamental problem here. His books are short. They're short. The one we're about to discuss was 64 pages long, and that's fairly long for him. And of course, they're heavily illustrated, and they're in rhyming verse mostly. And so they're not meant to be 2 hours long or an hour and a half long. I mean, they're meant to be petite.
Yeah, snippets, short stories, right, essentially.
So the minute you expand them to feature film length, you're already betraying Dr. Seuss on one level right away, which is you're betraying his brevity.
Which is the soul of wit.
Yes, it is. And that's why these are witless movies.
Oh.
The one we're talking about is How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
The live action.
Right.
Version.
Yes, not to be confused with Chuck Jones' wonderful animated half-hour TV special done in 1966, which was done with Dr. Seuss's active participation. He wrote the screenplay and he wrote the lyrics for the songs, the music by Albert Haig. And that's a perfect adaptation of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Perfect, because it's just under a half hour long. It's got clever songs. It's got Dr. Seuss's fingerprints all over it.
The animation is true to the art. Plus you had Chuck Jones at the helm, and it doesn't
right.
get
and
better
And Boris
than
Karloff
that.
Narrating it.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it's just right. Just right. And this feature film is just wrong. It's so big. It's so heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Everything is so clumsy and lugubrious.
Ooh, great word.
Well, that word was invented for this movie.
Lugubrious. And it's so dubious.
Oh, man. And it was done by, you know, talented people. Ron Howard directed it. And his longtime producing partner, Brian Grazer, they hired the two guys who framed Roger Rabbit, the screen adaptation of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Okay.
Jeffrey Price and Peter Seaman. So, you know, they had a good track record behind them. They were among the writers of Wild Wild West, not as successful.
Ooh.
And they're also on the team that wrote Shrek the Third. But their main credential at that moment was Roger Rabbit, and that's a heck of a credential. But I don't blame them either. I just think this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
To make this movie.
The moment it got a green light, we were kind of that was the problem.
Yeah. Don't do this. Don't do this. Leave it alone. Leave the book alone. Leave the TV special alone. It's been done. It's been done well. It's been done extremely well. You're not going to do better.
Well, what is the mentality behind it? Like we have to introduce this story to a new generation of kids.
They can justify all they want,
yeah,
Baron. You know as well as I.
Well, they kind of
that TV special is on every year.
But they turned a lot of people off of Dr. Seuss.
Well, I would think so.
I think there were some people who had never. Some people, they were children. You know, I can think about my little sisters even, mm-hmm. who were young enough for this movie when it came out, mm-hmm. that were just like, oh, is this what Dr. Seuss is? Is this what I've been hearing about? And yeah. they never got
and they,
into it.
They thought they had a perfect idea, too, in casting Jim Carrey.
Who I love.
Now, Jim Carrey's great.
He's a human cartoon, quotation marks.
That's right. Jim Carrey, I mean, if you were going to do this, he'd be the right guy and was the right guy to cast. And Rick Baker, the brilliant makeup artist.
Rick Baker, monster maker.
And his partner on this one, Gail Roll Ryan, they won an Oscar for their makeup, and no argument there. Because one of the things they managed to do with Jim Carrey is turn him into the Grinch, but never lose sight of Jim Carrey's face.
Right.
He is equally Jim Carrey and the Grinch. That's tough to do. I mean, you could never really see Boris Karloff in that Frankenstein makeup.
No.
It was great makeup, but the actor was kind of lost under all those layers of you know.
Although I feel Karloff, that's what he wanted.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
But here, Jim Carrey is very present. And
looks great.
And he looks great. Everybody looks great. I mean, it's a very, you know, it's a film with a lot of imagination.
And then.
But it's so heavy-handed.
Yeah.
And Dr. Seuss, that's a description you could never use for Dr. Seuss book.
Yeah, there's no joy in this in it. And like you said, it's witless. It's just kind of very, very severe where they've taken this gorgeous story, which is about, you know, having a heart.
Right.
Finding out that you have a heart and right. being moved, and they made it a movie in which no one is moved. Or at least I'm not moved.
It takes place in the village of Whoville. Where all the Whos, you know, look forward to Christmas as the big event of the year, all except that hermit-like fellow who lives on a mountaintop just outside of town and who despises Christmas and everything it stands for. It's a story that you could tell very briefly, but they chose not to.
Yeah.
And gosh, I saw this at a Saturday morning screening. My daughter was young at the time.
Oh, goodness.
I saw it at a Saturday morning screening at the Universal Amphitheater, which I think seats 3,000.
Okay.
It
wow.
It was packed with families and kids. Packed. And at the climactic moment of the film, when the Grinch has to make a crucial decision, spoiler alert, crucial decision, and makes the right decision and saves the sleigh, Santa's sleigh, and lifts it up, it's a moment in the film that invites the audience to cheer. No one cheered. talk about a litmus test.
Right.
This audience was saying,
we don't care.
Yeah.
We don't care about this.
No, because they've been beaten senseless long before then. That's what this film does. It beats you senseless.
With the Grinch Club.
The only thing I can say that is kind of a backhanded compliment, but okay. I can say is it's not as bad as The Cat in the Hat.
Oh, yeah. The Cat in the Hat is
with
abysmal.
Mike Myers, which is unbelievably awful.
Yes.
Doesn't even have the qualities this film can boast of.
We should have talked about The Cat in the Hat.
No. That would have made me.
That would have been.
I might have gotten
you would have
sick.
Came in here just the punching. Just like, yes. I'm going to punch, and if you run into my fists, that's yes. your problem.
The
Grinch,
dear.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas, not so much.
No.
Although, and you know what I miss a big from the original animated Grinch is the voice of a man named Thurl.
Oh, Thurl Ravenscroft.
Ravenscroft.
I'm such a fan of his.
Who you might remember as the voice of Tony the Tiger.
Yep.
They're great. But he also sings, "You're a rotten.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
Mr. Grinch." I always used to change those lyrics to just horrible things.
Just the best basso voice in Hollywood history. Great, great
talent. "You're a Nazi with a syringe, and you're chasing me down the alleyway." Nope, that's just my lyrics.
Okay. Those are the Baron Vaughn lyrics that you can immediately...
Still better than the movie of How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Yeah, well, yes, that's probably true.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to let it go. I want to expel that breath as I just did and get this out of my system because we have a wonderful movie to talk about now.
A true classic.
You got it. Coming up in just a moment.
Mr. Grinch, you really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch.
Now on Thursdays from the founders of the ultimate industry screenwriting staple, The Blacklist, comes The Blacklist Table Reads, an exciting new podcast that takes the best screenplays Hollywood hasn't made yet and turns them into movies for your ears. Every month, The Blacklist Table Reads will be turning one script into four weekly episodes, complete with writer interviews from Blacklist founder Franklin Leonard, a fusion of classic radio theater with the most talked about scripts in Hollywood. Seriously, a truly unique listening experience. Their first script is the outrageously satirical comedy Balls Out by Malcolm Spellman, currently a producer on Empire, and Tim Talbot, winner of the 2015 Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at Sundance, with the cast featuring Paul Scheer, Matt Walsh, Lauren Lapkus, Casey Wilson, and more. Ooh, and more's in that? I love "and more." The Blacklist Table Reads, Thursdays on Wolf Pop.
Welcome back, one and all. This is Leonard Maltin, and with me
is Baron Vaughn. For this movie podcast is called Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
That's exactly its name. We're going to do something we haven't done yet. We've been doing this for just over half a year now and still enjoying it 100% and really, really having a wonderful time learning about movies, revisiting movies we like. Reminding ourselves why we can't stand certain movies.
But reminding ourselves why we love certain other movies.
That's right. But what we've done is mostly contemporary films, almost entirely contemporary films, by which I mean the last, 20, 25 years or so. We've stretched into the 80s, 30 years or so.
Mainly because we want to talk about movies that you, the listener, can easily find and watch on your various streaming services.
Right. And that you're likely to be interested in. And we haven't really delved into classic Hollywood.
Yeah, we haven't gone before. Well, we talked about Miracle on 34th Street, but that's the oldest movie we've talked about so far.
That's right. I forgot we did. That's a classic from the Golden Age, and that's the first one we did. Well, we're going to do a second one. And the one we're going to do now is based on James Hilton's novel Lost Horizon from 1937, directed by the great Frank Capra. What a movie.
Yeah.
I saw this movie. One of my mentors showed me this movie when I was about 12 years old, and I was just enchanted by it. That's the only word I can think of. I was enchanted by it. And the first thing I did was I went out and bought a paperback
of Lost Horizon?
Lost Horizon by James Hilton and devoured it. And again, it's significantly different from the movie. They added characters. They combined characters. They made a number of changes. Robert Riskin, Frank Capra's great, great partner, collaborator, screenwriter, made significant changes to the book that he thought would make the work better as a movie.
Mm-hmm. More cinematic.
You can debate whether those changes are good or not. It's a wonderful book and it's a wonderful movie. And yet it was a movie that was not a great hit in its day. Not a flop, but it cost so much money to make. And it was a bone of such contention between Frank Capra and his number one patron sponsor, the head of Columbia Pictures, Harry Cohn, that from the moment Capra finished his so-called final cut, which was like 3 hours long, they started trimming and then more trimming and then whacking away at it. And it has been cut and recut, and footage has gone missing for decades.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
And then finally in the 70s, the American Film Institute and UCLA and Sony, which owns Columbia Pictures Library, got together and worked on the best restoration they could come up with to restore it to 132 minutes, just over 2 hours, which is what the initial release version was. So it's pretty well intact now.
Did you watch it on Amazon?
Yes, and there are those sections where all they have is the soundtrack for a couple of scenes.
Yeah, they make a little announcement, well, a little visual reading before the film where they basically explain a little bit about what Leonard's talking about, and they say that they found an audio track, and they just basically use still photos. It wasn't jarring, I have to say.
No, it's done pretty well.
Yeah.
It's done pretty well. There are two key scenes, maybe three, where you have to look at stills.
It's about 7 minutes of footage in the full film altogether that's like that.
And but it makes it kind of an object lesson in film preservation.
Yes.
And that in itself is interesting. But the story, let's get to the heart the heart of it. I want to read you, I wrote down these words.
Please do.
Because it opens with a book. I love movies that open with a giant book.
Okay.
An unseen hand opens the giant book. And it says, in these days of wars and rumors of wars, haven't you ever dreamed of a place where there was peace and security, where life was not a struggle, but a lasting delight? Of course you have. So has every man since time began. And that's what this film is about. It's about finding that perfect place, finding that utopia, but a utopia with a purpose, a utopia that has been designed. It didn't happen by accident. And we don't want to give away too much because some of you won't know the movie and won't know the novel, so we're going to be careful what we reveal here. But we're introduced right away to the hero of the film, played by the great Ronald Colman, my wife's favorite movie actor.
There you go.
And one of my favorites, but it's her absolute favorite movie actor. A handsome, dashing man.
Very classic look.
Possessed of the most beautiful speaking voice, perhaps, in the history of movies. Just British.
Yeah, very British.
Wonderful,
incredibly British.
Wonderful voice. He is a his character, Robert Conway, is like a roving ambassador for Great Britain.
But more importantly, a cynic.
Well, yes. Well, that's what the public doesn't know.
Yeah,
is that they know him as a negotiator, a peacemaker, an envoy,
diplomat.
But at the beginning of the film, he's trying to evacuate British nationals from Eastern country that's in turmoil called Bascul.
There's some unrest with some racial tension going on that has turned into basically rioting and a war, and they're trying to evacuate people out of here. Suddenly, our hero finds himself on a plane with a couple other characters.
Right, and they've been sending plane loads out one by one as soon as they can get them into the airport and away from the rioting crowds. And he's on pretty much the last plane with a disparate group of people. And they take off, and after they've been in the air a little while, they discover that the pilot is not the man they thought was their pilot, but an Asian man who is holding them prisoner.
Is flying the opposite direction, who knows where. They're just in the sky for what seems like a very long time because they kind of go a little crazy up there.
Yep. And in best Hollywood fashion— each character on that plane is very distinctly drawn, and they're all great, wonderful character actors of the period. The only one who's not a great actor is John Howard, who plays Ronald Colman's brother. He's a little He's a little over the top.
Is he American?
Yeah, he is.
Because I believe he's supposed to be British.
Don't go there.
In this film.
Don't go there.
But there's no point where he sounds British, especially next to Ronald Colman with his with the most British of voices.
Exactly.
But it doesn't – just let it go. Let that go.
If you're not accepting of these things, you can't watch them.
It's 1937, right. People.
Thomas Mitchell, a wonderful actor who you may recognize from Gone with the Wind, replaced Scarlett O'Hara's father, or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or John Ford's Stagecoach. He was a very prominent character actor. He plays a man with a kind of a shady past. You don't know what he's about exactly. You find out later. And then a very kind of a fuss budget character. Huh. If you look up the word fuss budget in the dictionary, there's a picture of this actor, Edward Everett Horton, one of the busiest and most beloved character actor comedians of his time.
What's that word again? Fuss budget?
Fuss budget, yes. Oh,
not to be confused with Flibbertigibbet, which would have a picture of Meg Ryan.
He might be that too.
Okay.
He might be that too. Edward Everett Horton, wonderful. A later generation came to know him as the narrator of Jay Ward's Fractured Fairy Tales on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show.
Oh, yeah, okay. I recognize the voice.
He lived a long, long life and a distinctive voice and a distinctive personality. Then there's a woman who we don't know much about. In fact, she's a prostitute, but in those days they couldn't say that. She's played by an actress named Isabel Jewell, who had just worked with Ronald Colman a short time earlier in A Tale of Two Cities, in the climactic scene of that great adaptation. And they're all headed, they don't know where. They don't know where they're headed. Plane crash lands in the Himalayas.
It's snowy. It's snowy, dark.
Remote.
Cold.
The pilot is killed in the crash. That's not a big spoiler, really. But they're rescued. Miraculously, they're rescued by a mysterious man who speaks English and a troop of guides who they need desperately to guide them away from this crash site over the rough, rocky terrain over the mountains.
He says something like, it's not that far away, but it will be difficult to get to. What's not that far away?
Yes, exactly. Well, where they're going is a place that is protected from the elements. It's like a valley, the Valley of the Blue Moon, and it's an oasis. It's a literal oasis from not only from the snow and weather and Mother Nature at her most ferocious, but it's an oasis from the battle of civilization.
Society is out there. We're in here. Isn't that awesome?
And it's called Shangri-La.
Let the music play.
And if you've ever heard the name or the term Shangri-La, it's not out of folklore. It's not out of some obscure reference. It was invented, that name was invented by James Hilton for this novel and later this movie. That's where the term comes from.
Hmm.
In fact, in 1942, when U.S. had a very successful sneak bombing raid led by General James Doolittle.
Who did a lot.
Yes. President Roosevelt was asked, where'd the planes come from? Because it was a very long-distance bombing raid. And he said, Shangri-La, he said. And it put the word back into the conversation, and so Columbia reissued the movie.
Huh.
On the strength of that reference by the president. During World War II. But unfortunately, they cut the movie some more when they put it back in theaters. And they wanted to not make it seem like – they didn't want a movie that seemed pacifist in tone because we were in the midst of war.
Right.
So they trimmed some dialogue, some very crucial dialogue, which has all now been restored, thank goodness. Anyway, what it's about is about this man who is a globe-trotting diplomat.
But feels unfulfilled.
But yes.
There's something missing.
And he knows that he's been living a lie.
Mm.
He says at one point he's managed to save the lives of all these British people in Basque. He says he can't stop thinking about leaving 10,000 natives behind to be annihilated. He's got a conscience. He's got a worldview. He doesn't have tunnel vision. And he finds in this place, Shangri-La, not just an escape. It's not that. It's something more than escape. It's a higher purpose that is presented to him. And that's where we're going to start getting vague. We don't want to give away what the movie unveils layer by layer. Now, Baron, you'd never seen this before.
No, I haven't.
And did it get to you?
Oh yeah, I mean, I said this to Leonard before we were recording, when we were walking over here, and it was just nice to see a film that tells a story with dialogue and acting, and a man named Frank Capra being resourceful with how he's going to shoot things and how he's going to reveal information and put it together, and It was really nice to watch, and I also just liked the length of the scenes that you do get to be with these characters. And just like you said, like in the beginning when they're in this plane, the camera basically moves around the airplane body, you know, the seated area. There's a couch in there. We don't have to worry about that. But we meet each character and see them interact, and it's just there's a lot of care and time just put into that. And it was just nice to be like, oh, we're going to find out who each of these people are right now. And we get that information, and it's not – what's the word? It's not boring. It's not laborious.
Yeah.
It's – they're good performances. And then they crash, and then we're in there. And then I just kind of liked that there was all these people that were somehow in Shangri-La and couldn't handle it. They're just like, wait a minute. Things are too perfect in here, because it resonated – for me, in terms of our cynicism as a society now, and that, like Man of Steel or Batman versus Superman. I mean, the Superman of our era he's a scary thing. He's some scary thing, and what is he? And he's all powerful, and we're a fear culture. So these characters have that feeling there. Then they land in this place where it's like, whoa, we can kind of have everything we want. Is that okay? And
but oddly, and I'll call back to Cider House Rules, they all discover that they need to be of use.
Yes.
That's what's going to give them contentment. Contentment is not idleness. Contentment for them is to find a way to be of use.
And to be part and be useful to a community.
Yes.
And that's what's interesting about this film. And I really, really enjoyed it.
It's my wife and I had such a good time watching it again. It had been a while since we'd seen it. I introduced it once with Bob Gitt, the man who did the restoration for UCLA Film Archive.
Very nice.
And Jane Wyatt, the leading lady.
Oh, wow.
We did this at the Last Remaining Seats series here in LA maybe almost 30 years ago. And she was very charming and had nice memories of making the film. And then I was at another screening where John Howard was there. It was, I wish I'd had my tape recorder, had the brains to write down every utterance, everything these people said. But it's a film that has a fascinating backstory. You can read Frank Capra's autobiography and get his version of it, which is apparently a little embellished and a little simplified. Or you can read Joseph McBride's incredible book called Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success. Which tells the real story, which is actually even more interesting than Capra's version. Capra said that after a disastrous preview, he took the first two reels of the film and threw them in the incinerator. Well, you didn't really do that with film. It would blow up.
Right, because it was highly flammable.
Exactly. But he did, in fact, cut the first two reels, because originally it was told in flashback.
Oh.
It was told as a flashback story. The scene that is now the last film of the last scene of the picture, which I won't detail.
Yeah.
But you'll remember it. That scene in the British Club. It's not really the last scene. It's the penultimate scene.
The whole film was told from that perspective?
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that it became like a this is a present day story. We're following these people as it happens.
Right. Right. Whew. So really interesting history. Really interesting backstory. And not everybody loved it. Not everybody thought that utopia that the art director Stephen Goosen put together and that the great cameraman Joseph Walker photographed, not everybody liked it. They thought it looked kind of sterile. Not everybody took to the whole idea of Shangri-La as well as the literal depiction of Shangri-La. I love it. I love everything about it. It just gets to me. And of course, I did see it at the impressionable age of 12 for the first time.
Right.
So I have that cherished memory of it, being introduced to it too. So that probably has a lot to do with it.
But that's
as well.
Also sort of part of the point of the film is that Shangri-La is what you make it.
That's true. That's exactly right. Now they made an unfortunate musical version of this in 1973.
Oh yes, yes.
Unfortunate being a gentle word. It had a score by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, the great songwriting team.
Oh.
This was not their finest hour.
Oh, no? How'd it go for them?
Not well. I think it precipitated their breakup as a team, if I recall correctly.
They couldn't agree on Paradise?
And, oh, gosh, it starred people who didn't sing. It starred Peter Finch and Liv Ullmann with a colorful, to put it mildly, colorful supporting cast. it was just a disaster of a film. Mm. A disaster of a film. Has its moments, but not enough.
But this a movie is, musical yeah, of a movie, of yeah, this movie.
This is the real deal. Accept no substitutes. Get Frank Capra's 1937 classic Lost Horizon.
37, not 73.
Not 73. Don't invert those numbers. That would be a foolish thing to do. If you're curious, then look at the musical. I mean, from a just a clinical point of view, it's interesting to see how they took a wonderful story and kind of blew it. and partly through miscasting, among many other problems.
Right, right.
But now James Hilton isn't very well known today, but he was a best-selling author at that time. And there were other
big—
Yeah, I had to
rewind. At first I thought it said Milton. I was like, wait a minute.
He had a series. He had a run of hit, not only popular books, but they became hit movies. Goodbye, Mr. Chips from 1939 with Robert Donat. Mrs. Miniver, an emblematic wartime film with Greer Garson and Walter Pidgeon. And another wonderful movie, Random Harvest, with the same— Ronald Coleman in the leading role with Greer Garson. Those are all good movies. Random Harvest is probably my favorite of those, but they're all good. And Robert Donat is just wonderful in Goodbye, Mr. Chips. He won the Academy Award. That was the year of Gone with the Wind, when Gone with the Wind swept almost every Oscar except Best Actor, which was given to Robert Donat for his lovely performance at Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Huh.
So anyway— I digress, as I tend to do when I talk about old movies.
That's what podcasts are for.
Oh, good.
I believe
they
used
to
call these recorded digressions.
Okay.
And they decided that was too long.
Well, I will digress no more. I will just say I love this movie, and I hope you give it a shot. If you don't know it, and of course, yes, it is an old movie. You cannot watch a 1937 movie and expect it to look like a 2015 movie. The style of acting is different. The style of storytelling is different.
Yes.
All of that.
Culturally, things are different. Mm-hmm. But, you know, does the film create a world in itself, among itself? Yes, it does. It tells a story from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And I liked it a lot.
Some other time we'll talk about the actor Sam Jaffe, who I don't want to discuss here because I don't want to say much about his character, but he plays Father Perot. I'll just put it that way.
Oh, okay. Okay, okay.
Very interesting guy. Well, folks, that's it. We've talked about three movies today. We've talked about, just to recap.
Yes.
Talked about The Cider House Rules.
See The Cider House Rules.
Great adaptation.
Follow the rules, but see The Cider House Rules.
That's right. Great adaptation by John Irving of his novel. Then we talked about, reluctantly talked about, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Blasphemy.
Oscar-winning makeup.
Oscar-winning makeup. Well-earned. But go see look up the stills online and admire the makeup in still photo form.
Yeah.
Don't bother with the movie. And then Frank Capra's Lost Horizon from 1937, scripted by the great Robert Riskin. And there you have it. Three films worthy of discussion and two well worth seeing. So there. We've said
so
it.
So there.
We said it because we met it.
Audience.
And we'll be back with more of this next time. And until then, Baron, tell people where they can see. Well, they can see you on Grace and Frankie.
On Grace and Frankie, that's right. Streaming on Netflix right now.
You have there's some fairly nice co-stars working with you in that show.
Yeah, just a few up-and-comers. Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Martin Sheen, Sam Waterston. You know, it's a couple people that are trying their hand at this acting thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you help them along?
I tried, but, you know, they were like, no, I got it, Baron. So I let them kind of do their own thing. It was a fun time. You know, all the episodes are streaming right now. Binge it. That's the way people do it now. I'm also on Twitter. BARVONBLAQ. Leonard, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin or at my website, leonardmaltin.com.
Do you talk about this and that there?
I talk about this and I talk about that.
Oh, perfect.
It's what I do. Friends, always happy to have you with us. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your encouragement. Tell your friends.
All of your friends and your family.
Every darn friend you have, because we want to keep doing this for a long, long time. We appreciate your being here. We'll see you next time.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.